those that buy more fuel and driving on the roads are actually using the roads more. They're getting very much benefit of what they're spending because they're getting roads that get maintained.
Lawmakers consider a hike in fuel taxes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the community on St. George Island is waiting for an emergency water delivery after damage impacts their storage tank.
The ice came crashing down and apparently crushed the water line on the inside.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Lawmakers are considering tripling the state's motor fuels tax over the next 2 years. A bill would raise the tax from a national low of 8 cents per gallon to 16 cents in July, then 24 cents per gallon in July of 2018. The money would be designated to maintain the state's roads as well as airports and ferries. Transportation Commissioner Mark Lukin told the House Transportation Committee last week the state would spend the money carefully.
My commitment to you is that, you know, we will be accountable to Alaskans, to you as our investors, for these funds that you're investing in this department.
While the legislature opposed all tax increases last year, some powerful lawmakers have signaled an openness to considering raising the motor fuel tax for the first time since 1970. They include Senate President Pete Kelly.
And I don't mind having the lowest in the nation, but certainly we need to update it from time to time.
Adjusted for inflation, the 8 cent per gallon tax in 1970 would equal 50 cents today. If the tax is raised to 24 cents, it would still remain below the national average. Some lawmakers who represent Matanuska-Susitna Borough residents express concern that the tax would be a burden on those with long commutes. Wasilla Representative Colleen Sullivan Leonard was among those expressing concern about the tax.
Who's going to be affected? And it's going to be my residents, and it will be significant. Every penny, I think, is very detrimental.
Anchorage Representative Matt Clayman noted that people who benefit the most from using the roads would pay the tax.
Even though those that buy more fuel and driving on the roads are actually using the roads more, they're getting very much benefit of what they're spending because they're getting roads that get maintained.
Representatives of airlines and other businesses that use fuel are scheduled to testify regarding the bill in the House Transportation Committee on Thursday. Governor Bill Walker has issued a disaster declaration for the winter storms that struck Savunga and Gamble at the end of 2016. Almost $3 million in public assistance, state, individual, and temporary housing assistance will be given to the St. Lawrence Island communities. According to a press release, Governor Walker signed the disaster declaration on February 1st. This allows state public and individual assistance programs to help communities repair utilities, public buildings, and other critical infrastructure that was damaged by the storm. In order to repair the more than 30 damaged homes in Savunga, as well as the city of Gamble's water tanks and other damaged buildings, the estimated cost is a total of nearly $3 million. Michelle Torres with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management says a team from the division will travel to St. Lawrence Island sometime next week to provide assistance. St. George Island is waiting on an emergency water delivery after falling ice damaged the community's reservoir yesterday. In St. George, water is stored in a 280,000-gallon steel tank that draws from an aquifer. The reservoir isn't insulated, so when cold winds batter the island from the north, water freezes inside the tank, usually near the top. Mayor Pat Pletnikoff says that leaves ice hanging dangerously as the water level drops, like it did yesterday.
The ice came crashing down and apparently crushed the water line on the inside, pinched it off, and caused a huge restriction. As a result, the reservoir went dry, and we're pumping water in, albeit very slowly.
Pan Air is sending a cargo plane to St. George tomorrow with 300 gallons of drinking water. The regional carrier plans to bring another 2,000 gallons soon after. Between those deliveries and the steady, slow refilling of the reservoir, Pletnikoff says the island's 100 residents should have enough water as the city makes short-term repairs.
Oh, I think we'll be okay after tomorrow. There should be enough water level buildup in that reservoir sufficient to charge the lines into the community, and so water should be available to our residents.
Pletnikoff says the tank has had problems with ice for at least 6 years. 3 winters ago, the roof nearly collapsed when heavy chunks of ice brought down several rafters. St. George is working to design a new reservoir with insulation through the state's Village Safe Water Program, but Pletnikoff says it's not clear yet who will pay for the structure or when it will be built. The U.S. Senate today voted to confirm Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary. DeVos is the only one of President Trump's cabinet nominees so far to face serious trouble on the Senate floor. Senators were evenly divided, 50-50, and Vice President Mike Pence cast the tiebreaker in favor of confirmation. Alaska's two senators were split. Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of two Republicans to vote against DeVos, while Senator Dan Sullivan voted for her confirmation. DeVos, a billionaire and frequent political contributor, has been active on the issue of school choice. Critics say she would undermine public education by sending tax dollars to private schools. Murkowski says the nominee did not know enough about public schools to fix their shortcomings. Sullivan, though, says DeVos convinced him she cares about the education of all students. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, public testimony over making Fairbanks a sanctuary city for immigrants.
I really don't think that we can bring in any people that don't know how to survive in Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The state gets its bulk of its royalties from oil produced on the North Slope in the form of oil rather than payments from the producers. This week, lawmakers are considering a contract to sell some of that royalty oil to the Alaska-owned refinery and fuel marketing company, PetroStar. Jim Schein, commercial manager for the Division of Oil and Gas at the state's Department of Natural Resources, says the state makes more money if it receives its oil in kind, or in oil, rather than in value, meaning in cash.
When the state elects its royalty in value, the producer ships the oil and sells it alongside their own production on the state's behalf.
That means the state has to pay what it costs to move that oil from Valdez to the West Coast. On average, that's about $3.50 per barrel. So for the last 38 years, the state has kept its royalty oil and sold it, dodging that transportation cost. Usually the state sells to in-state buyers. Currently, the state is in a 5-year contract with Tesoro. It sells between 20 to 25,000 barrels per day to the company. By contrast, PetroStar, a subsidiary of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, would be able to draw about 19 to 23,000 barrels per day this year. That number will drop over the next 5 years based on state estimates of lower flow in the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
So in the past, the state has had maybe a little more comfort in our royalty shares over a longer period of time. For instance, we've had 10-year contracts for royalty sales before.
But as volume in the Trans-Alaska pipeline drops, so does certainty in the amount of oil the state will have to sell. Currently, the state has a $46 million bond from PetroStar to cover the costs of the company defaulting on payment or the state having to resell the oil. Schein says the state can readjust that bond, usually based on the price of oil, that amount every 3 months. This year, the state expects to get 50 to 55,000 barrels per day of royalty oil from North Slope production. The Fairbanks City Council heard testimony last night from members of the public concerned about executive actions by President Trump blocking Syrian refugees and a temporary traveling halt to the U.S. from 7 primarily Muslim countries. Rose O'Hara was one of several who asked that the council make Fairbanks a sanctuary city for immigrants.
Immigrants are the building block of what makes America great. Since our grandparents and great-grandparents came to this country, our family has worked hard. My generation of siblings were the first to go to college. We work in education, public health, for the CDC, water management. We are privileged to grow up in a country that welcomes all.
A sanctuary city is defined as a municipality that does not prosecute unauthorized immigrants and makes local government services available to them. Another speaker last night, Darlene Herbert, expressed concern about sanctuary status attracting more immigrants to Fairbanks, citing tough financial times and the difficulties of living in the far north during the winter.
There's going to be starving people in Alaska. I really don't think that we can bring in any people that don't know how to survive in Alaska. So I don't see how you can be a city that can bring in people. And most of them come from a country that's very warm. So all we're going to be doing is picking up their frozen bodies.
Fairbanks Mayor Jim Matherly says the city will investigate sanctuary status. Some council members voiced general support for the idea. An agreement between the state of Alaska, the city of North Pole, and Flint Hills Resources will expand the municipal water system to properties impacted by spills at a former refinery. The refinery closed by Flint Hills 2 years ago was the site of historic spills of the industrial solvent sulfalane. The settlement covers more than 650 parcels of land where North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward says affected residents will have access to public drinking water.
Provides for expansion of the North Pole utility system within the city boundaries as well as outside city boundaries to include the existing sulfalane plume and then also a buffer around that.
Ward adds connection charges are covered under the agreement, which also lays out a timeline for the expansion.
Construction is expected to begin in 2018, and then operation of phase 1 and 2 would be 2019, and then construction of phase 2 and 3 would be 2019 as well.
Flint Hills has provided impacted residents with drinking water since the contamination was discovered, and Mayor Ward says that will continue until the expansion reaches their property. The settlement covers areas where groundwater is projected to be impacted by 2030, but State Director of Spill Prevention and Response, Kristen Ryan, says no one will be left out.
If our modeling is off and homes are impacted that are not on the piped water system, there is a commitment that water would be provided if their drinking water is impacted above the EPA screening level for sulfalane.
The groundwater contamination was first reported in 2009, and it's unclear how long area residents were drinking from tainted wells. Little is known about long-term impacts of consuming sulfalane, and Ryan says the state is awaiting research results. The sulfalane spills at the former North Pole refinery primarily occurred when the facility was owned by William Alaska Petroleum, and Ryan says the current settlement does not include the former owner.
Continue that litigation with a trial set right now for May.
Williams could end up contributing to the North Pole Municipal Water System expansion, which is estimated to cost up to $100 million. Under the current agreement, Flint Hills will cover 80% of the cost, while the state covers 20%. A public open house about the water system expansion is scheduled for February 25th at the North Pole Library. It's the first winter in Bethel since a liquor store opened after almost 40 years of illegal sales. Alcohol is easier than ever to get, and Bethel Search and Rescue says the number of calls they receive, almost all alcohol-related, has spiked. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports volunteers are getting worn out, resources are depleting, and the organization is asking the community for help.
2 weeks ago, Bethel Search and Rescue got a call. A man had left Bethel sometime after midnight, heading to Akiak on a four-wheeler. He had been drinking, hadn't arrived in the village that morning, and the caller was worried. Bethel Search and Rescue went looking and found the man, Charles Williams Jr., age 29, dead on Steamboat Slough. He had apparently frozen to death. It was Bethel Search and Rescue's first body recovery of the winter, but the all-volunteer group doesn't know if it'll be the last.
We would ask if you come to Bethel to buy booze, bring it home first, then start consuming it there for their own safety and safety of others.
Mike Riley is the president of Bethel Search and Rescue. Since November, when the river and overland trails froze, opening the pass to Bethel from the surrounding villages, the organization has seen a spike in calls. Most involve alcohol. Historically, about 95% of the calls Bethel Search and Rescue receives involve alcohol. That percentage is still basically true, but instead of getting a few calls a month during the winter like past years, Search and Rescue is getting about 2 calls a week, usually between midnight and 6 a.m. Responding to such a call can be tough. John Wassily has volunteered for Bethel Search and Rescue for more than 30 years. When a call comes late in the night, he's usually the first to grab his gear and go, waking up to jump on his snow machine and head out in the dark and the cold to look for someone. All he knows is the person was heading in a general direction and maybe the color of the person's vehicle or coat. But finding them is just half the work.
They don't want to listen to you. They don't want to reason with you, and they want to try get home.
He says when people have been drinking, they're not thinking clearly. They're verbally aggressive, and often they'll use whatever they have on them as a weapon. Broken sticks, bottles.
Even their groceries, you know, when they're drunk, because, you know, they don't know what they're doing.
Half the time, Wassily hogties the person he's found, just to contain them, so he can get them out of the cold and somewhere safe. The late nights, the physical danger, the emotional abuse, it all adds up. Bethel Search and Rescue has 100 members, but only about 10 regularly respond to calls. At least one has talked about quitting. Others are taking indefinite breaks. Also, President Mike Riley says the group is funded through donations, and the current call rate is unsustainable for their budget.
It's okay for now, you know, but if we keep this up and we keep going up and we're out of our own pocket, we'll be hurting if we're funded.
The group is all volunteers, and most have jobs, families, and other commitments. Dozens will come out for big searches, the kind the group was created for, of people getting trapped in unforeseen circumstances, like a blizzard descending on a snow machine or a boat stranded in a storm. Now members say it's become drunk patrol, and a lot of people aren't willing to head out looking for another intoxicated person at 3 in the morning. But when the group was formed, it made a commitment to help anyone who needed them, a commitment it's kept. And one President Riley says it will continue.
We're going to keep on going for the people's sake out there, for their family's sake. The biggest part of it is keeping everybody safe and bringing them home.
Anyone can become a member of Bethel Search and Rescue. The next meeting is the group's annual meeting and is February 15th at 7 p.m. at the Bethel Search and Rescue Building. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical cost. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
After 4 years, convicted murderer Newton Lambert of Juneau may finally get an answer about whether he will get a DNA test in his case. As KTOO's Matt Miller reports, the case focuses on evidence left over from a 35-year-old double murder in Juneau.
The Alaska Court of Appeals in October heard arguments in the Lambert case that may have been one of the first applications of a 2010 law that allows for post-conviction DNA testing. The appeal stemmed from consideration of the case by a Ketchikan Superior Court judge 4 years ago. An opinion in the case is now pending. During oral arguments, the panel's three judges seemed to doubt that DNA analysis of two potential evidence samples would necessarily lead to establishing Lambert's possible innocence in the 1982 murder of Ann Bonulkin. Michael Schweiger of the Public Defender Agency argued for Lambert before the appeals court. Schweiger said the DNA test could generate an important investigative lead that could help track down another suspect who may be listed under a nationwide DNA database called CODIS, or the Combined DNA Index System. Two key pieces of evidence from the Lambert case were last reported still in storage in a California laboratory. They are identified as sweatshirt and pants swatches taken from the clothing of Ann's husband, James Bonulkin, that apparently contained traces of blood and semen. Lambert was convicted by a jury in the April 1982 murder of Ann, but he was acquitted in James's murder. In this exchange with Schweiger, Judge Marjorie Allard tries to summarize Lambert's current claim before the potential filing of another application for post-conviction relief, or PCR.
If we test the semen on the pants and it turns out to be Lambert, well, so be it. But we'll run it through CODIS, and we might get a hit off of CODIS, and then that would lead to additional investigation, and we would be able to talk to that person who there was a hit off of, see if they confess, see if there's connections between that person and Lambert, or if you can establish there's no such connections, and then proceed with the PCR.
Thank you. Yes. So this is the initial subsequent step. This isn't walking Mr. Lambert out of jail. This is not an extraordinary remedy. This is a very, very ordinary. I don't know what the opposite of extraordinary, but this is a very, very small remedy. We're just asking for the test.
Assistant Attorney General Elizabeth Burke of the Office of Criminal Appeals argued against granting the current application for post-conviction relief. Burke didn't think that Lambert adequately established his claim of innocence, which she argued is required before any DNA testing of evidence.
It's really hard for the state to assess his claims, and while this court might be familiar with this case and the evidence outside of the actual record in this case, a defendant is supposed to cite to actual evidence in the record to support his claims, and he didn't do that here.
Lambert is currently serving a 99-year sentence for the murder of Ann Bonulkin. Co-defendant Emmanuel Tullis, who was arrested along with Lambert, was later acquitted at trial of murdering both of the Bonulkins. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Veteran Yukon Quest champion Brent Sass was the first musher into Dawson City today, roughly the halfway point along the 1,000-mile trail. He's followed by another past Quest winner, Hugh Neff, currently a little less than 20 miles from the checkpoint. Matt Hall and Alan Moore are less than a mile apart in third and fourth position. Behind them are Ed Hopkins of Canada and Quest rookie Catherine Keith of Kotzebue. It's a relatively tight field as mushers speed toward Dawson on the tail end of a 105-mile stretch. By early this morning, as KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, this long, remote portion of the race route is testing mushers as they begin to feel the effects of marathon racing.
Matt Hall put foot warmers in his boots at the Pelly Crossing Rec Center on Monday morning.
We're only at the second one.
No, you're at the third one.
Oh. I'm really tired.
The 26-year-old musher had slept about 30 minutes in the past day. When he finished eating a homemade egg scramble, he went back outside to wake up his team. It was about 30 below zero when Hall took off, fourth out of the checkpoint.
You guys ready?
In the past 48 hours, he had spent maybe six of them inside. Pelly Crossing is a Selkirk First Nation village on the Klondike Highway, about a third of the way through the 1,000-mile race. On Monday, mushers started showing up to camp in the parking lot. They laid out straw, cooked up steaming pots of meat and kibble, and laid blankets over their dogs. The dogs were fast asleep by the time mushers came inside, ate some chili, and tried to rest for an hour or two in a shared bunk. At this point of the race, while humans are struggling to stay awake, dogs are just kicking into high gear.
We're, you know, 250 miles into a race now, and I try to stop them, and they're screaming and hitting the line, and it's like, wow, if you guys had a week off and we hooked you up, you wouldn't be this excited to go.
For mushers, trying to stay awake will only get harder as they embark on the longest distance of the race. Dawson City is separated from Pelly by 200 miles of hilly, desolate country. Though Hall is one of the top contenders this year, he said he wasn't racing to Dawson, where the first musher in wins 4 ounces of Klondike gold.
I don't know, we'll try and bank a little bit and save for after Dawson, I think.
Paige Drobny rubbed herbal oil onto her dog's paws next to the baseball diamond in Pelly. Her team was quietly huddled under colorful blankets and sleeping bags. She said her dogs were also hitting their stride. But she still wanted to give them 6 hours of rest to get ready for the big run ahead of them.
Like, I'm going to give them a longer rest here, and they probably don't need it, but, you know, with the 200-mile section ahead going into Dawson is just a little bit more daunting than just, you know, checkpoint to checkpoint. So I just want to make sure that they're, you know, more rested and are able to do what I want them to do when I go out there.
One of her young dogs, Chevelle, was helping keep everyone's spirits up on the trail.
Because Chevelle, like, squeals. She was in lead, and there was a big hill that was like straight up, and we kind of had a little lag there when my sled caught up and she started squealing, and everybody just barreled down and just dragged me up the hill. I didn't even have to kick or anything.
After Pelly, mushers face the Black Hills, a series of steep climbs culminating in 4,000 foot King Solomon's Dome, the first big summit of the race. They also have really heavy sleds packed with 200 miles worth of dog food. UConn musher Ed Hopkins said it's important to know your team really well at this point of the race, because you can't afford to carry your dogs through the next section if they're not pulling their own weight.
Well, you better make sure you evaluated your team properly between CarMax and here before you blow through here, right? If all of a sudden you start packing dogs, this is your last spot. You can actually see vets and have a chance to look over your team and stuff.
Hopkins was still recovering from the last run when he got thrown off his sled by a chunk of jumble ice on the Yukon River. Mushers are required to take a 36-hour layover when they get to Dawson. For the first time, they're allowed to receive outside help from their handlers, and they can finally get some sleep. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Pelly Crossing, I'm Molly Reddig.
Yukon Quest officials report veteran musher Jason Campo of Alberta, Canada, scratched from the race, citing concern for the yearling team he was running. Laura Neese and Ed Stielstra scratched this afternoon in Pelly Crossing. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rasha McChesney, Andrew Kitchenman, and Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Davis Hovey in Nome, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Molly Reddick at Pelly Crossing. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel February 15th and 16th at the AVCP Housing Authority Conference Room from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.